shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening. This is Brother Mike of Kingdom Identity Ministries, welcoming you to another one of our First Sunday Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. We're being heard tonight over radio station WWCR 4.840 megahertz and 5.890 megahertz. That's transmitters 3 and 4. And also shortwave station WBCQ 7.490 megahertz. Both of those radio stations have a stream. Well, in this case, you'll be able to pick up the broadcast directly from our radio archives because due to my guest schedule, we're pre-recording this broadcast tonight, so there won't be any phone calls taken. My guest tonight is an author, an historian, a world traveler, a scholar, and the director of the Institute for Historical Review. And I'd like to welcome back to the broadcast Mark Weber.
Thank you very much, Mike, for having me back on. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, there's a lot going on in the world, especially in the Mideast. It seems to stay very active there. Recent Iranian agreements, which were for the purpose of peace, at least that's what they purport to be, are being heavily condemned not only by war hawks in the Republican and Democrat Party, but specifically by some of the Republican candidates for president. Would you like to begin by talking about the Mideast in general, the position that some candidates have taken? And I know you've been a traveler to Iran, so basically reality versus the propaganda put out in the establishment media.
Right. Well, of course, the Institute for Historical Review has a big focus on the origins and the consequences of war and conflict. And that goes back to the First World War, the Second World War, and the Iraq War, and the prospect or the danger of a war with Iran. As you know, and as you mentioned, a number of American politicians have been very critical of Iran and have talked about it as a threat to the United States and to the world. And they're echoing in that regard the claims made repeatedly by Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has spoken more than any other single person to joint sessions of the U.S. Congress warning about Iran. Netanyahu has said over and over that Iran is just very close to having nuclear weapons and that Iran has to be put under great pressure to try to keep it from developing nuclear weapons. Now, and of course, a number of American politicians have repeated and echoed what Netanyahu has said. Now, there's a number of things that are very important about this agreement that the American public is very misled about. When the agreement was announced, one of the major television networks presented it by showing John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying that the agreement had been made with Iran, and then immediately a cut was made to asking the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu what he thought about the agreement. Now, this is extraordinary. This is astonishing because it misrepresents what this agreement really is. It's not an agreement with Israel, and it's not an agreement between just the Iran and the United States. This agreement is an agreement between Iran and the United States and Britain and France and Germany and Russia and China. In other words, the United States is just one of several major countries that have made this agreement. And Netanyahu's claim that the Obama administration has been misled and tricked by Iran is on its face astonishing, because it would mean that Iran has had the ability to not only fool Barack Obama, who I can understand people don't trust very much, but has fooled the leaders of Russia, of China, of Britain, of France, and of Germany at the same time. Because the agreement is an agreement that everyone in the world is basically going to benefit from, except Israel and maybe Saudi Arabia. And I'll go into the reasons for that. Benjamin Netanyahu's claim about Iran are false on the face of it. They're absolutely untrue. He's been claiming for more than 20 years, this is important, for more than 20 years, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has been claiming that Iran is just a year or two away from developing nuclear weapons. Well, not only is it absurd on the face, because if Iran was trying to build nuclear weapons, it would have done so a long time ago, but his claims are contradicted even by the head of U.S. intelligence. Not only the head of U.S. intelligence, but U.S. military intelligence, which has said and affirmed repeatedly that Iran has no nuclear weapons program. And this is the determination that's been made also by the leaders in France, Germany, Britain, Russia, and China. Now, when France and Britain and Germany and Russia and China all agree on something, you can pretty well think that there's a good reason why all those countries would agree on it, because they're not normally countries that cooperate closely. And if the leaders of all those countries, including the United States, hold one view and Israel holds another, it's pretty easy to determine, I think, who's not telling the truth and who is in this matter. But American politicians, especially in the Republican Party, have been echoing the claims by the Israeli leader, not because they care about the truth of the matter, but because they're very heavily beholden to the immense power of the organized Jewish community in American politics. Especially in the Republican Party, a Jewish billionaire named Sheldon Adelson, who has made his money in gambling casinos around the world, has been an enormous benefactor and funder, contributor to Republican candidates. And he's very, very pro-Israel. He's emphatic in his pro-Israel support. And that's the tragedy of America, that politicians, not only in the Republican, but of course in the Democratic Party as well, represent not the best interests of America and the world, but represent the interests of those who fund their campaign. Because American democracy doesn't really work the way that it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be, in theory, a system that that people are elected to represent the interests of the American people. But in fact, politics is largely determined by who has a lot of money. Anyway, the agreement with Iran is one that the entire world, except for Israel and Saudi Arabia, which is a rival of Iran, has opposed, not because they think the deal itself is wrong, but Israel is fearful, and in a way understandably fearful, that Iran's influence and power is going to increase in the region. Iran is a country of some 80 million people. It has a very long, venerable, cultural and historical heritage. Iranians are the heirs of the Persian Empire, which at one time was the world's largest empire and covered the area from Europe all the way to India. And Iranians are a very proud people, have a surprisingly well-developed country, to anybody who visits it can easily determine. But Iran's leaders are very anti-Israel. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the leader of Israel, is very fearful that Iran's influence is going to grow, and that's already obviously the case. Just in recent weeks, because Iran has complied, as it said it would, with the agreement made between itself and those other countries I mentioned, the sanctions are beginning to be lifted that were imposed against Iran, and Iranian leaders are making very large multi-billion dollar trade deals with France, with Italy, and of course with businesses in China and Russia, and also with Germany, so that Iran's influence and is going to be growing in all those countries as well. In fact, Iran now has a position generally in the world much stronger and better, I think, now than Israel, except in the United States. And the reason that there is such support for Israel in the United States is not due to any objective concern for the best interests of America, but is based upon the enormous power that the organized Jewish community, the Jewish lobby, the Israel lobby, has in the United States and its impact, especially on the Middle East.
Of course, they own the news media, too, the various networks.
They have enormous power in the media, and this power is not just direct in the news media. It's also a tremendous cultural influence based on years of motion pictures by Hollywood to play up propaganda, emphasizing the Holocaust, emphasizing Jewish interests in such a way that the American public has been softened up to think that Jewish concerns and Jewish interests and Israeli interests deserve almost automatically our support. This cultural influence and the media influence can hardly be emphasized enough. It needs to be really stressed for anyone to understand American cultural life and political life. It's very important to address that influence. And that influence is manifest, of course, in so many ways. One of the most remarkable speeches made in the last several years was by Vice President Joe Biden in May of 2013. This is almost three years ago. Joe Biden addressed a Jewish meeting in Washington, D.C., and he acknowledged, and this is what he said to this group, that the Jewish role and influence in the media and cultural life in the United States, he called it immense and outsized, and said it's the single most important factor in shaping American attitudes over the past century and in driving major cultural, political changes in American life. In other words, this media influence isn't just in smaller issues. As Biden acknowledged, it's a major factor, a decisive factor, in promoting acceptance by the American public of gay marriage or same-sex marriage, for example. Joe Biden made this explicit point. And it's one of the reasons why the United States is so much more fervently supportive of Israel than any other country in the world. And it's not
they also ignore some of the things that the Israelis do to the Palestinians, for instance, or the aggressive acts they do against some other countries.
Right. Very true. I mean, there's so many expressions of this in our life, not just ignoring how Israel treats Christians in the Middle East, but how it treats another non-Jews under occupation, but its policy in the Middle East. One could take easily the view that, well, what Israel does or the conflict between Jews and non-Jews in the Middle East, it's really none of our business. That's the attitudes, for example, of China. China doesn't particularly get involved in the Middle East. It's far away. It's not their conflict. They stay out of it. They don't have bombs going off in Chinese cities because they stay out of the matter. But America has the role in the Middle East it does, involved in all these different wars and conflicts, above all because of its strong support for Israel. Now, for most Americans, I'm afraid, wars overseas are something that are far, far away. Many Americans don't really understand or appreciate or grasp just how profound, how costly, how immense the consequences of these wars are for the American people. The Iraq War alone, the United States invaded, bombed, and occupied Iraq in 2003, cost hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, it's estimated to cost even up to $1 trillion. Hundreds of billions of dollars, enough to build, I don't know, countless roads or schools or sports centers or whatever you have in the United States. And, of course, many thousands of Americans were killed, and, of course, many larger numbers of Iraqis. But these wars take place far beyond our shores in a way that I think Americans traditionally don't really understand just how terrible and how the great consequences of war can be. I lived in Europe for several years, and of course anybody who lived in Japan or China or lived in Europe, especially in Poland or Germany or Russia, has a much adult or mature understanding of what war means than America, because for our country, the wars take place far away from our shores. Our soldiers go off somewhere and they come back and life more or less goes on without any great changes. Whereas for other people around the world, when wars take place, it means bombing and destruction and huge disruption of their lives, suffering and misery on a vast scale, something that very few Americans, I think, really fully understand or appreciate. Now, America today is a very different country than it was back in the 1960s or 70s or even 80s. We're now living on a credit card. Our country is enormously in debt. Every year now, what we fund in our Social Security, our Medicare, and our military operations overseas has to be done by borrowing against the future. That is, American politicians are funding and approving programs that our children or grandchildren are supposed to pay for, but we don't have the ability and the money to pay for it. This is a very, very, of course, dangerous situation, and it's a different situation than it was in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and so forth in those years right after World War II. Now, back to Iran and the Middle East. What the United States is talking about, it still has troops in Afghanistan. Its involvement now, the Obama administration, supported by both parties, of a big role in the Syria conflict. All of this is really, America would be far better off if we stayed out of those conflicts, because we can't, as we should have learned, are not able really to solve the problems and the conflicts involved there. And our involvement over the last 14 years and 15 years has been largely a very negative one, not only for us, but for the people involved in the Middle East as well.
Well, every country that America went into, in one way or the other, is in worse shape today than it was when we invaded, such as Libya and Iraq and so on.
You know, in the run-up, in the weeks going up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, in March of 2003, there were many voices raised against warning against going into Iraq. People who knew the Middle East, journalists, and even retired U.S. Military leaders, even the Pope, warned that the U.S. invasion of Iraq would be a catastrophe. It would unleash tremendous forces of chaos and disorder that would have terrible consequences over the long run. But George Bush and most of the leaders of the Congress of both parties supported him in this ill-fated and destructive conflict, including Hillary Clinton, by the way. I mean, to me, Hillary Clinton's support for the Iraq war ought to be enough to disqualify her forever from holding any higher office. But the American public is really sick of these wars, and this is manifest, I think, it's one of the reasons why Barack Obama was elected. But the Republican leaders in general talk about doubling down on this and increasing America's military role in those regions, which would be, again, an additional catastrophe. One consequence, by the way, of the involvement in the Middle East and the chaos of the Middle East has been to increase the flood of migrants now and refugees, so-called refugees or migrants from Syria and other parts of the Middle East into Europe, which, of course, is now such a big problem that it threatens to destroy European cooperation and even the European Union.
Same thing's happening here from the invasion of illegals, some of them Syrian, but of course most of them over our southern border.
Right. There's much more, of course, that can be said about this. But, you know, with regard to the Middle East, the U.S. ambassador to Israel even said publicly several years ago that the centerpiece, the litmus test of U.S. policy in the Middle East, the central consideration is whether a given action is going to be good for the security and the interests of Israel. This is very dangerous because American foreign policy should be based primarily on what's good for America, and then secondarily, I think, for the world, not what's good for Israel. And making this alliance with Israel is extremely dangerous because it makes Israel's enemies our enemies. And Israel's enemies, of course, there's a lot of them. It's invaded quite a few countries, much as the United States has also invaded other countries.
But I understand that Iran hasn't invaded any country in quite a few years.
Iran has not attacked another country in over two centuries. For 8 years, Iran was involved in a terrible war with Iraq, a war carried out by Saddam Hussein, a war that took they estimated 1 million casualties on both sides, a very destructive war in Iran. People in Iran, of course, are very conscious, very mindful of this terrible war. And in that war, the war was begun when Saddam Hussein's Iraq attacked Iran. And the United States during that war supported Saddam Hussein. That's even more, of course, the Iranians know this and they remember this. Very few Americans know or care about this conflict, but it's one that people in Iran are very aware of, very, very mindful of. And there's many reminders of that in Tehran and around the country. But, yeah, Iran has not attacked another country in two centuries. Iran has been a very strong and consistent opponent of al-Qaeda, of the ISIS, of the so-called Islamic State in Syria. But the United States does not have a record anywhere like that of Iran, and consistently, the United States has not had any consistent policy in the way that Iran has, or even, for that matter, Russia.
And Iran, at this time, doesn't have any nuclear weapon, but yet the Jewish state in Palestine has many.
Yes, this point needs to be stressed very strongly. Netanyahu has been repeatedly calling for the world to punish Iran for what it might do, but asks the world to give it a pass on what it has already done in flouting and defying international law and building a nuclear weapons arsenal. And according to U.S. intelligence, the technology or the knowledge for this Israeli nuclear weapons program, which began back in the 60s, was based first and foremost on stolen uranium from the United States. No, one of the most remarkable things about the Israeli nuclear program, a nuclear program that Israel will not publicly acknowledge that it even has, although that's confirmed by American intelligence and American officials and so forth, that the Israeli nuclear program, which began during the 1960s, began, according to WikiLeaks and other documents, with technology or uranium, plutonium, stolen from the United States itself. But in this case as well, the United States holds other countries to a standard that it does not apply to Israel. I've said repeatedly that if the United States applied the same standards to Israel that it has applied to Iraq or Iran or other countries, it would be invading Israel. It would be bombing Tel Aviv, and it would grab Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders and put them on trial for crimes against humanity and violations of international law. Now, I'm not saying that's what it should do, but that's what the United States would do if it applied the standards it claims to enforce around the world in an even-handed and across-the-board way.
What's amazing is that at least one politician, and I'm sure there's others, that oppose interventionism in the various countries, Rand Paul, he turned around and he appointed one of Benjamin Netanyahu's top aides as somebody to help him in his campaign. And when the press asked him what he was going to do, instead of saying that he was going to help Rand Paul with his campaign, he said he was going to do everything he could to help the Israelis.
Well, Rand Paul is, of course, for many people who supported his father, a big disappointment. His father had the support he did because of his support for principles, his honesty, his consistency, and unfortunately his son thought he was going to be clever by paying attention to polls and so forth. We've seen his campaign, of course, disintegrate as a result, because the American public is really across the board sick of politics as usual. That's obvious. They don't care if these candidates call themselves conservative or liberal or left or right. They're so unhappy. Americans are so unhappy with the general drift and trend of American life that they're willing to support people as unusual as Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. It's astonishing, really, how many Republicans are supporting Donald Trump to me, because Republicans used to say that, well, if you ask them what they're trying to conserve, if they're conservatives, they'll say the Constitution. But Donald Trump doesn't seem to have any particular support for the U.S. Constitution. He makes it sound like he would rule almost by decree. But the point is, he's a very unusual, but people like the fact, of course, that he's speaks from the shoulder, even if it's often in a way that's very offensive to some people. But that's sort of
and he's
different
about
American.
The only one that's actually standing up verbally, anyway,
right.
against the Mexican invasion there, wanting
that's
to build
right.
the wall
that's
at
really
all. I'm not saying he would fulfill it, but...
Right. We don't know, actually. It's a big gamble about Donald Trump, too. But at least he's made that an issue, and to his credit, has forced everyone to talk about it in a way that no one did, for everybody wanting to ignore, all these politicians wanting to ignore that issue. I mean, at least it's certainly livened up the campaign. As we speak now, it's unclear, especially after Iowa, what's going to be happening. Yeah, it's a very rocky road, and really is an expression of just how unhappy Americans are with the general. You know, one public poll just a few weeks ago, we put it on our website, showed 60% of Americans say they don't recognize America anymore. Large majorities of both parties are unhappy. People who call themselves Democrat and Republican are unhappy with the general direction of the country. They say the country's going in a bad direction. You know, it's extraordinary just how disappointing politicians have been. After 8 years of George Bush, his administration was a calamity. Republicans like to forget he was ever president. But there's a similar disappointment and unhappiness with Barack Obama by the American public. It's hard to remember, or it should be remembered, just how euphoric, how optimistic so many people, not that I was particularly, but or maybe of your listeners, but many people around the world in America thought that Barack Obama was going to usher in this radiant, wonderful new era in American life, especially with regard to race relations. And yet, a recent poll shows Americans think that race relations are worse today than they were when Barack Obama became president. And that's the one thing he was supposed to solve or deal with. This is extraordinary. In his State of the Union address just a few weeks ago, Barack Obama acknowledged implicitly anyway, that his administration has been a failure in this fundamental way. And after 7 years of Barack Obama and 8 years of George Bush, the American public is understandably very, very disgusted, contemptuous of politicians and their promises.
Well, on the right, you have betrayals or sellouts or at least they fizzled out, the so-called Great White Hopes that we've had over the years, the Ronald Reagans and George Wallace and Pat Buchanan and, you know, you name it, we've had a number of them, and it just doesn't turn out.
Right, that's right.
I guess supposedly it's Donald Trump now, and I doubt that he would fulfill the hope if he were elected.
Well, I agree with you. I have arguments with people about Donald Trump. I know people who are very strong supporters of Donald Trump. I only caution that there's nothing in his lifetime career to, I think, give anybody a confident hope that he's going to do anything other than what he has done for most of his life, and that's do what's good for Donald Trump. Donald Trump has no record of consistent principle on anything, really. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
He didn't get where he is without playing ball with the international Jewish bankers. I mean, financial deals of various kinds. His own daughter married a Jew and converted to Judaism.
Right,
and,
right. Well, he was...
You know, and his top aide is named Cohen, I believe.
Right, right. Well, yeah, but I don't want to get into the specifics because it's a fast-changing scene. We don't know what's really going to play out. And regard again to the Middle East. American policy in the Middle East for at least 50 years has been one of very, very strong support for Israel, even in the face of Israel's violations of international law, even when it carries out policies directly opposed to what the United States leaders would like. It's astonishing. The real problem isn't what Israel does. The real problem is something very fundamentally defective in our political system that allows a strong and influential minority with tremendous political clout and media hold to have the huge influence on our national life and our cultural life and our political life as it does.
Well, of course, on the other hand, countries like Iran are demonized. How did you find the people when you visited that country in general? What were they like?
Well, Iranians are a very proud people. Their identity is they're Muslim overwhelmingly, although unlike America's main Arab allies, Saudi Arabia, there are protected Christian and even Jewish minorities in Iran. Iran has at least a dozen synagogues. It has Catholic and Christian and other churches in Tehran. And by law, there has to be at least one member of the parliament has to be a Christian and a Jew, by the way, because they're so-called protected peoples of the book, according to the Islamic interpretation. But Iran is a very rapidly developing country. They have a more than 100% cell phone usage. I mean, there are more cell phones in Iran than there are people. There's a very large university population. More women than men are students at the universities in Tehran. Streets are packed with cars, and it's difficult to get around. It's very important to remember that Iranians are not Arabs. They are Persians. The language is related to European languages. So, in fact, there's a centuries-long kind of animosity between Persians or Iranians on the one hand and Arabs on the other. Iranians have, astonishingly, a very favorable view about the United States. In fact, it's even naive, I would say. They want very much overwhelmingly good relations, but they are very opposed to American policy. Iranians are all aware and remember the U.S. role by the CIA in 1953 overthrowing the Iranian government of the Prime Minister Mossadegh. It was a coup carried out by the British and especially by the CIA. They also remember the role of the Shah of Iran, who was basically a puppet of the United States for many years. Iranians are proud. They don't want to be told how to live and what their life should be like by the United States or any other country. Young Iranians are very outspoken. They'll tell you what they don't like about the government or their regime. But I think that it's hard to know for sure, but and I tried to, in many ways, to determine how much support does the regime, the Islamic Republic, have from the population. I think it's about as broad-based a support as is going to happen in that country, certainly more than the Shah had in the final years.
Would it be different in different sections of the country?
Yes. The wealthier parts of Tehran, and North Tehran is the wealthy part of Tehran, people there tend to be more critical of the regime than in most of the country. North Tehran and the wealthy population, they tend to be more secular. They want more open and normal relations with the rest of the world. So there are some differences in that way. Also, Iran.
What about the racial makeup? I know that many of those that we view on television, for instance, are kind of a swarthy Mideastern type look. Yet I've seen some very fair pictures that look Nordic of a certain Persian.
Yes,
or
that's right. Yeah, Persians are, they vary a great deal. I had a long talk with a Iranian professor who actually was blonde-haired and blue-eyed. Most Iranians look, Middle Eastern, as it were, but only about 60-70% of the population of Iran is Persian. They have large minorities that are Arab or Zeri or Azerbaijani or Azeri, Baluchi. They have some minorities as well, especially on the frontiers, the borders of the country. But yeah, there are differences within the country, and Iran has a political system that combines elements of a theocratic state and elements of a democratic state. They have elections regularly for the president. But the candidates are vetted, and the much of the power is held by a so-called supreme leader who's chosen by a smaller committee very dedicated to the Islamic State. But the president, Rouhani, is very popular, especially because he has succeeded in organizing this deal with the United States and Britain and France and the other countries to bring about an end to sanctions. And there's a great deal of optimism that things are going to be better in the next several years.
Well, let's hope that these not betrayed by the U.S. and Britain and the other countries that agreed.
No, most of the world has a very realistic sense about Iran. Most of the world understands that Iran's system of government and religion is different than their own, but the world is like that. Because other countries have different political systems or religions should not be a reason why we should be at war with them or why they should be hostile. If we applied that standard across the board, of course, the United States would not be allied with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world named after a family, the Saud family. Women can't even drive cars in Saudi Arabia. By the standards that we apply to Iran, we shouldn't have any alliance with Saudi Arabia. But, you know, the world is made up of many different countries and different societies and different forms of government. And our foreign policy, I believe, should be essentially the one that George Washington and other American leaders upheld for many years. That is, try to cultivate good relations with other countries, but no what they called entangling alliances. That's what Jefferson and Washington warned against. We shouldn't have a passionate attachment or a passionate with other countries, and we shouldn't have a passionate hatred for other countries. And we shouldn't get involved in the disputes and the turmoil of other regions.
A lot of it's done behind the scenes. Like, I know that Lawrence of Arabia was promoting favorable, and they viewed us as favorable, relations with the Arabs. Then they turned right around, and he opposed it and made the Balfour Declaration.
Well, that was especially the role of Britain, which played a dominant role in the Middle East, of course, in the 1800s, 1900s, and the 20th century. I mean, Britain was the, up until the World War II, played this dominant role in Iran, for example. The company that in the United States operates under the name of ARCO, or BP, was originally the Anglo-Persian oil company, and it's now BP, and of course they own all the ARCO stations in the United States. But that was based on Britain's domination and control of Iranian oil. And Britain promised independence for the Arabs if they would support Britain in World War I. But at the same time that they were promising that Palestine would be ruled by Arabs, they were promising Jews that Jews would take control of it. But that's and then the United States, of course, then supported the Balfour Declaration, and that double standard, that duplicity, has been a hallmark of American policy for many years.
What do you see as perhaps the future, both what is being promoted by the various political parties in this country and also the possibility of people wake up to reality?
That's, of course, as one person famously said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. A couple of things I would say. America's role in the world is going to decline and has been declining, in spite of its tremendous military power, because America doesn't have the same economic clout and political clout that it had in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. When Donald Trump talks about making America great again, he talks about how we're going to have American cars instead of Japanese cars in roads around the world. That's just not going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is because America doesn't produce good quality products at a good price as well as other countries do. I was just recently in Turkey, and I spent some time there. Back in the 1960s, the automobiles on the roads in Istanbul were American cars. Now there are no American cars. America doesn't sell cars, very few anyway, around the world. In Turkey or in many of these countries, they buy cars made in Japan or Germany or Italy or Korea or China. They don't buy American cars. And America can't play the same role in the world that it used to, in large way, because America isn't any kind of model society. People around the world don't say, I want our cities to be like Los Angeles or Chicago or Detroit. They want to avoid the kind of problems America has. And Americans understand that. That's why they're very unhappy with the direction. Now, what I mean is, overall, America's ability to act, you know, in a way that's positive and constructive in the world is decreasing, not increasing. And this is going to have more and more bad consequences for Americans. But America is still the number one military power in the world by far, and it still has more financial power than any other country, although that's being challenged. But economically, it's being challenged increasingly by China. In other words, the world situation is a very different one than it was 20, 30 years ago. And the best policy America can have is to take a realistic, make policy that based on a realistic assessment of what's really going on in the world. But we have such problems internally here with our cities, with our educational system, our high levels of crime and disorder, that I think the primary focus ought to be on solving the problems we have here within our own society and within our own country, first and foremost. But that's going to be very difficult because the American people generally want simple, easy solutions to very difficult and very entrenched problems.
They're promoting the different peoples. The founding fathers were of white European Christians, and now we're getting in every race. In fact, I understand that legal immigration, let alone illegal, is only like about 10 to 12% white anymore.
Right. Well, this is a very fundamental problem of, well, you could say that in any society, or even for individuals, the first and foremost way to deal with issues is to have a firm understanding of who we are, of our identity. And that goes for societies and countries as well as it does for individuals. And America has a very confused sense of identity. It claims to be a country for everyone, but that's not what the essence of America is. America was, the central fact of American history is that it was founded and developed by Europeans. That's a central, important, overriding reality of American life. But Americans don't have taken that fact for granted. They like to say that this is a country for everyone. Ronald Reagan used to say that America is a special country, that God had a special plan in mind for people who believe in freedom. In other words, it's a country for everyone, regardless of race or background or so forth. But if America were settled by people from, primarily developed by people from Africa or Asia or another place, it'd be a very different kind of country. But that, to me, is the central dilemma of, and tragedy of America, is that the most important features of American life we take for granted. America is changing rapidly, but you ask Americans, well, should America be for whites or should it be for everybody? Well, Americans are very uncomfortable saying it should be just for Europeans. Well, if you say it's for everybody, well, you're getting everybody. People shouldn't be surprised by these trends in American life because for many, many years, we've supported people who say that's what they want. That's the kind of America they want. And we're getting that.
Well, our culture is being constantly criticized while they're pushing diversity, and diversity is another culture.
Right, right. Well, yeah, of course. And I think that if the history of the 20th century shows anything, it shows the weakness and fragility of multicultural societies. We have so many refugees from other from some countries, precisely because they are multicultural societies and people don't get along very well. Societies are far stronger, far more durable, far more peaceful when they're cohesive, when they represent one culture, whether it's Japan or, to take an example, and multicultural societies such as Yugoslavia or the old former Soviet Union or even Czechoslovakia broke up precisely because they were trying to combine different peoples in the same government, in the same society. I mean, Americans understand that on a kind of instinctual level. We know that Detroit is different than, Salt Lake City because the population is different. Different kinds of people make different kinds of society. And Americans sort of understand that, and they live their lives in reality like that, but our ideology says that that's not true, and we're trying to make reality conform to the ideology and not the other way around.
I think that people in general in, say, Great Britain, Germany, the United States, understand that something's happening that's not desirable, yet the politicians are pushing it because that's the politically correct thing to do.
Well, it's politically correct. That's right. I mean, that means years of propaganda, conditioning, media, and so forth have promoted this idea of what life in society should be like. I'll give just one example. I mean, one of the most popular television shows and series of movies in recent years is Star Trek. It was a very popular show when I was growing up on television, and a number of Star Trek movies have been made. And they portray this idealistic society on the spaceship Enterprise, in which there's one person who's Scottish, there's a Japanese fellow, there's this black woman, and then there's this half-human person played by Benjamin Spock, and that's considered the ideal. It's fantasy. It's absolutely ludicrous, the idea that at some point in the future there's going to be some fellow still speaking with a Scottish accent. If the trends continue, there people speaking with a Scottish accent are going to be about as common as people speaking Hittite or Assyrian or another dead language. It's just fantastic. But this is the ideal that American media and American politicians have promoted for years. This notion that, well, we're all basically the same, we're all just going to get along, it's all going to work out, is promoted by our motion pictures, by our politicians, and in our schools, in our classrooms.
Now, the motion pictures show the black as the hero, the great scientist, and so on, and it's just not statistically that way out here. Yet that's right. What they're promoted, and that's what people believe is true.
Right. Well, we have politicians who, when they passed in the year 2000 or 2001, overwhelmingly passed the No Child Left Behind Act. It was passed by overwhelming support of both Democrats and Republicans. It was signed by a Republican, George Bush. And the premise of this No Child Left Behind Act is ludicrous. It's based on the idea that human beings are formed entirely by their socialization, by their environment, by their upbringing, and that heredity plays no role at all. It's ludicrous. It defies common sense and life experience. But this ideology-based idea is the foundation of American policy and law. And, of course, the No Child Left Behind Act, like so many other American policies, have been failures, have failed, have been fiascos. And they're going to, because you can't defy the laws of nature. You can pass all the laws in Washington that won once, but if they're going to try to order water to go uphill or other contempt for nature, it's not going to happen.
Well, I understand that 75% of what you are depends on your DNA, on your heredity, and only 25% on environment. But if you destroy that heredity through the intermingling of the races, you've destroyed the race that accomplished certain purposes. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's obvious that the white European race has accomplished much more than the other races, but just not even speaking of that, it's if you destroy it genetically, we no longer have the people that achieved these different achievements.
Yes, okay. Yeah, I was going to make the point about how our view about history has changed in American life. Every October we have something called, we used to have something called Columbus Day, and honor was paid to the man who, as it were, discovered America in 1492, sailing for Spain, Christopher Columbus. Now, many parts of the United States have renamed that. They call it Indigenous Peoples Day because they say that the whole notion of Europeans or anybody, quote, discovering America is patronizing and condescending because the Indians were already here. So they talk about the Indigenous Peoples of Europe. Well, America wouldn't exist if it hadn't been, as it were, discovered or developed by Europeans. But more than that, the same people who think it's wonderful to defend the heritage of the indigenous peoples of North America from European encroachment are the same people who support the destruction of the indigenous peoples of Europe by massive outer European immigration today. In other words, the same people who think that defending the heritage of Navajo Indians or Tibetans is a wonderful thing do not apply and do not defend that same standard when it comes to people in Denmark or Norway or France or other countries. But that's how this politically correct thing works. It applies selectively, not across the board in that way.
Of course, you change the people, you change the pattern of voting and every other aspect of the country.
Well, of course, different peoples make different kinds of societies. To put it another way, as I've said, you can't expect to have a society like Switzerland or Denmark with a population like Ethiopia or Honduras. You can't expect a society like Japan with a population like Syria. And it's ludicrous, absurd, as our political leaders seem to think, that one can do that, make that happen. But that's what they say we're going to magically make happen in America in our time and in our age, in our country.
Yeah, and of course they teach that the Indians or the blacks or something, they can all have a racial pride, but if the whites have a racial pride of their heritage, that's racist. That's a terrible thing, you know.
Right. I want to bring that thought back to the Middle East again. Over and over, American politicians say that Israel must be supported as a specifically Jewish ethnic religious state. But they do not apply that same standard or try to uphold that same standard with regard to any other country. It's considered completely wrong and terrible to uphold Denmark or Sweden or Germany or Poland as a specific racial, ethnic, religious society. Those societies, we're told by our political leaders and by our media, should be multicultural. But Israel, our same political leaders tell us, must be defended and protected as a specifically Jewish ethnic religious society. That's a reflection of the enormous power that this lobbying group has. One of the most influential Jewish organizations in the United States is a group called the Anti-Defamation League, which has offices across the United States and a large headquarters in New York with a very, very large annual budget. And it promotes diversity, and it has huge programs designed to promote diversity, which they say diversity is our strength, they claim. President Clinton echoed this and said that in one of his speeches, diversity is our greatest strength. And yet, this same organization that promotes what it calls diversity in the United States or in England or in Germany or in other countries insists that this standard should not be the one in Israel. That Israel, by contrast, should be promoted as a specifically Jewish ethnic religious state. And that shows, I think, the fundamental hypocrisy and dishonesty of those people who promote that slogan.
Well, I think that the media, which is Jewish-owned to a great extent, and the movies and so on, well, even the textbooks and the public schools, they have this Jewish influence, and yet, except for a handful of us, nobody will even talk about it. It's taboo to talk about it in conservative circles, let alone liberal circles.
Right. You know, a lot of people pride themselves on how superior our culture is because we talk forthrightly about sex. Or supposedly we're not constrained by the inhibitions that people had in the 19th century in the United States or in England or other countries. But in fact, there's a tremendous inhibition in our society about these fundamental matters. Honest discussion, honesty about race and especially and Jewish influence in our society is taboo. And people who speak about it are vilified, marginalized, condemned. In fact, the power is so great that even to identify that power is considered breaking a taboo. And that's an expression, in fact, of that tremendous power.
People may turn into some kind of hate speech law. You know, you have in England and Germany and much of Europe and even on our border, Canada.
That's true.
You can't talk about the so-called Holocaust in many of those countries, and I'm afraid that a lot of that will rub over into this country.
At the same time that the government tries in the United States to force a lot of things to happen, the ability of American officials to make things work is less and less. Things just don't work in America. They're not able to enforce all sorts of laws that they want to enforce. There's a huge, large underground or black market economy in the United States. Lots of people carry out transactions that are in defiance of our tax laws. Increasingly, the United States is not a serious country. It doesn't act consistently across the board in enforcing many of its own laws. But that's been true of American life for a long time, but I think it's increasingly true. It's one of the reasons why, if there was a real enforcement of immigration laws, that would be startling, because we don't enforce a lot of our laws very consistently.
Of course, there's selective persecution of different people. I think the recent action against the BLM and others, of course, the famous cases are Waco and Ruby Ridge and so on, they do persecute certain people selectively.
Right. I don't know what note to end on, except to emphasize again the importance of highlighting and talking the truth about these issues that need to be talked about openly and honestly. A society that lives in denial, a society that suppresses the truth, it's an unhealthy society, and it's a doomed society. And that's a very major feature of America today, is a society that's in denial about very fundamental aspects of national life.
As you mentioned, we're coming to the end of the broadcast. Would you like to say a little bit about the Institute for Historic Review?
The IHR, we have a web presence, several websites we maintain. We give lectures and we hold meetings. We're one of the very few organizations of our kind in the United States that holds regular meetings, maybe 7-8 times a year. We do interviews quite consistently with media, not only in the United States, but overseas. We publish and distribute a wide range of books and discs, and I urge everyone to check out our main website, ihr.org, ihr.org. We update it several times a week normally with news and comment items on the homepage, and there's a tremendous library, a tremendous archive, material on all sorts of subjects. And, of course, I urge people to check it out. And if you like what you see, sign up for our email bulletin, which we distribute several times a week, and get on our mailing list, and you'll hopefully maybe even support what we're doing, which is essential.
Well, I'd like to thank you for being our guest tonight. And are there any concluding remarks that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I appreciate very much you having me on, Mike. I'm glad to be on with you. You are one of voices across the country who are trying to uphold a more truthful and honest and a reality-based understanding of our world, and that's really crucial. This is absolutely important work that needs to be supported.
Well, thank you, and thank you again for being our guest tonight, and we'll have to have you back again in the future.
Thank you very much for having me.
May God bless you and our listening audience. Good night.
Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our costs plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.